What are the fundamentals underlying the economic turmoil gripping China over the last 2 weeks? Does the collapse in Chinese stocks consolidate the global dominance of U.S. economic power worldwide, or does it do the opposite? Where do the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank and the One Belt, One Road project figure into economic plans for China and the region? Why is the infusion of more and more cash into the Chinese economy translated into more and more debt? How are other countries' economies likely to be affected in the wake of the Chinese stock market collapse? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we take a special look at the financial events of the first 2 weeks of January with two analysts, University of Manitoba Professor of Political Studies Radhika Desai and Dr. Jack Rasmus, economics professor and author. On this week's show, the Chinese stock collapse and prospects for the broader global economy. Conversations with Radhika Desai and Jack Rasmus. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of January 15th, 2016. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. This past week, markets all around the globe convulsed greatly with almost nothing left unscathed. There was a different excuse each day for the drops. We first heard about the Saudi-Iran disconnect of diplomatic ties, then everything was down because of the yuan devaluation and their market hitting the 7% circuit breakers. I even heard someone say that everyone has such great profits they wanted out, but not until the 2016 tax year, which is why they waited until the first week. I do not believe any of it, and would instead say we are simply receiving a global margin call. That comes from the article, Financial Meltdown, The Central Role of Credit, The Global Margin Call, Impasse in Monetary Policy, by Bill Holter, posted January 13th. Obama evaded the real issues that affect tens of millions of working people in America every day of their lives. He painted a ludicrous picture of economic recovery and social progress that insulted the intelligence of his television audience and went unchallenged by the millionaire politicians assembled in the chamber of the House of Representatives. Summing up what he called the progress of these past 7 years, Obama gave first place to how we recovered from the worst economic crisis in generations. The so-called recovery has been a bonanza for corporate profits, stock prices, and the wealth and income of the super rich. For the working people, who are the vast majority of the population, it has been a disaster. That comes from the article, Obama's Final State of the Union, Lies, Evasions, and Threats, by Patrick Martin, posted January 13th, originally appearing at the World Socialist website. In contrast to his decision to protect Nazareth and Christians, Dunkelman and his soldiers were ruthless in driving out Palestinians from many of the more than 500 Palestinian communities raised by Israel in 1948 and afterwards. In Safuria, a large Muslim village a few kilometers from Nazareth that was attacked by the 7th Brigade a day earlier, barrel bombs were dropped on the village as the residents were at home, breaking that day's Ramadan fast. All of Safuria's inhabitants were driven out and their homes destroyed. Today it is an exclusively Jewish farming community called Tzipori. Without a doubt, Dunkelman directly participated in the mass expulsion of many tens of thousands of Palestinian civilians from their homes, a war crime by the laws of war that had recently emerged in the wake of the Second World War. That comes from the article, Why Israel Has Silenced the 1948 Story of Nazareth's Survival, the Only Palestinian City That Was Not Ethnic Cleansed, by Jonathan Cook, posted January 13th, originally appearing in The View from Nazareth. The Syrian Air Force has targeted a convoy of 20 tankers smuggling oil from territories held by ISIS on the Al-Mayadin highway near the city of Deir al-Zar. A top commander of Al-Qaeda-linked Ahrar al-Sham terrorist group, Abu Talib, was killed in a trap explosion in the Idlib province. The Syrian army, SAA, and its allies clashed with al-Nusra and Harakat Ahrar al-Sham at the village of Jarijza, located north of the terrorist-controlled town of al-Rastan. The SAA reportedly killed about 25 militants and imposed control of Jarijza as a result of these clashes. Next expected aim of the Syrian forces is the town of al-Rastan. That comes from the article, Syrian Air Force Targets ISIS Tanker Convoy Smuggling Oil En Route to Turkey. Top al-Qaeda commander killed, by South Front, posted January 13th. Washington's aim to replace Iranian sovereign independence with Western-controlled puppet governance risks direct confrontation. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei's top military aide, Major General Yahya Rahim Safavi, explained the formation of a Tehran-Moscow-Beirut-Damascus-Baghdad anti-Washington Israeli-Saudi coalition. On Wednesday, Putin and Obama spoke by phone. A Kremlin statement said both leaders called for de-escalation of the tensions that arose in connection with the crisis in relations between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Putin seeks regional calm and stability, polar opposite Obama's imperial agenda supporting ISIS and other terrorist groups, stoking endless conflicts, allied with Riyadh, Israel, Turkey, wanting Iranian sovereign independence eliminated. That comes from the article, Does Washington Plan Greater Middle East War? Is War on Iran Still on the Pentagon's Drawing Board? By Stephen Lendman, posted January 14th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. As the Asian stock market comes to the end of its second week of trading in 2016, Chinese stocks continue their massive sell-off. China's benchmark index, the Shanghai Composite, ended its January 15th trading day down over 20% from their most recent high on December 22nd. The Chinese stock market's volatility is apparently impacting world markets. The January 7th shutdown of the market provoked drops of more than 2% in the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500. Japan's Nikkei dropped 2.3% and Hong Kong's Seng Index fell 2.8%. Franik Lun, the chief executive officer at GEO Securities Limited in Hong Kong, told the International Business Times, quote, "The bottom has fallen out of the market in the last 2 weeks. Investors have lost confidence after 2 weeks of meddling by government officials," unquote. China's previous bear market occurred in August, when $5 trillion were wiped off of global stock prices. On this week's Global Research News Hour, we look at the fundamentals of the Chinese economy and the recent stock market activity and try to determine what they portend for the global economy going into the future. My first interview is with a Manitoba-based professor of political economy who has been watching the Chinese situation and who appears to be not as panicky about China's prospects as other pundits in the mainstream. She last visited China around the time of the collapse in the summer of 2015. Radhika Desai is professor at the Department of Political Studies at the University of Manitoba and director of the Geopolitical Economy Research Group based at that institution. She's the author of the 2013 book Geopolitical Economy After U.S. Hegemony, Globalization and Empire from Pluto Press, among other books, and she's authored numerous articles in Economic and Political Weekly, New Left Review, Third World Quarterly, and other journals. She also organized last September's inaugural Geopolitical Economy Research Group conference, and she joins me right now to share some of her thoughts about the recent shocks affecting the Chinese stock market. So, Radhika Desai, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for asking me, Michael.
Now, I know that you've a major focus of your research and work has been the notion that the nation state is and has remained a critical tool and the development of global capitalism, and that the U.S. Is waning as a dominant economic power. Mm-hmm. And so I guess I'm just wondering if you would just care to, you know, just give a quick assessment of what this Chinese stock market collapse means in terms of with regard to your own work. I mean, does it confirm or does it refute your thesis?
I think that the first of all, let me say that there are several worrying things that are going on in China right now. One is that there is the fall of the renminbi. The second is the stock market crash. And the third is that there are numerous reports of a credit bubble. Naturally, none of these things are good news. However, I think that the extent to which, how bad the news is highly exaggerated in the Western press. And I would say that I expect the Chinese economy and the Chinese economic managers to weather these storms quite well, largely because I feel that China's growth story has been quite a remarkable one since the onset of the reforms in 1978, and particularly starting in the 1990s. Chinese growth has been extremely robust for 25 years or so.
7% per capita.
Yeah, it has had quite a remarkable growth run, and I don't think that it's going to stop necessarily. Yes, the Chinese economic growth, which was posting 10% growth rates, is now posting 7% growth rates, but even 7% is still substantially higher than what any of the Western economies have been able to post in recent times. So I would say that that underlying strength remains, and that underlying strength is largely a function of the fact that the Chinese economic managers have kept up a relatively high level of investment, and they determine the pattern and pace of investment in China. So I would say that that is likely to continue.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's just adding to that, though, is that what some people would argue as well. You know, we've also seen an explosion of government debt in just the last 7-8 years. That's quadrupled. Okay, so does that not? I mean, it's one of the most
debt.
The Chinese government. It's one of the most indebted countries in the world, and so I mean, a lot of that translates in the minds of a lot of pundits that much debt, and is like, how are you going to service it? Is that not a consideration when you consider this Chinese?
I think that definitely. I think that there is a okay. So, in order to understand this indebtedness, one has to understand that the way in which China dealt with the 2008 crisis, etc., was that basically it stepped up the rate of investment in the Chinese economy enormously, and naturally, this investment was connected with or was powered by a large expansion of credit. Now, the existence of credit is not really the most necessarily the worrying thing. The really worrying thing is whether the capacity to pay exists. And I think that while there may be a certain amount of bad debts in any kind of investment expansion, there will be some bets that fail. And I would say that then those debts may be written off. The important thing to remember here is that the Chinese financial system is owned by the is a government-owned financial system, and it is quite resilient and capable of writing off a lot of debts. And I think that the extent to which there will be bad debts in the Chinese system, again, can also be exaggerated. I think that it is quite capable of writing off the bad debts that will come up in the next little while, but I don't think that it will be a system-breaking thing.
Okay. Now, of course, you've got this BRICS alliance, right? You've got Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, and they've been posed as that counterpoint to the U.S. hegemony, as it were. And I'm wondering now with this latest development, what kinds of shocks might be present that might affect the sustainability or the stability of that alliance?
Well, I think that personally, I have always, while I do think that BRICS is not an unhelpful concept, and there is a sense in which the BRICS economies do have coordinated their actions at the international level and in a meaningful way, and they are in many ways transforming the structures of international economic governance. At the same time, I also put China in a class of its own. I think the Chinese economy, you were mentioning earlier that I talk about the centrality of the role of the state in the economy. This is obviously at one level a simple a refutation or a simple contradiction of the dominant neoliberal theme that only markets promote growth and states only interfere in economies and so on. And the most important piece of evidence against neoliberalism is that the most dynamic economy of the last several decades of neoliberalism has actually been the most state-managed economy in the world.
The least neoliberal
country in the world has been the most dynamic, has posted the most robust rates of growth, has lifted enormous numbers of people, millions of people out of poverty, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it has China's production structure has moved up the value chain quite substantially. It is no longer merely competing on low wages. I mean, all of these are very, very critical transformations, and they have been effected by a government that has, by and large, steered the economy fairly skillfully. In that sense, I would say that the Chinese economic growth remains slated to continue. We were discussing.
Wondering, because there are competing factions within the governing apparatus of China.
Yes.
So I'm wondering, like, who seems to be prevailing in the current milieu?
Well, I certainly, it's not, while I do not have any inside knowledge of the Chinese Communist Party, I certainly, from looking at it from the outside, following what's going on, looking at the reportage of the debates taking place within China, I would say that there is definitely a right and left faction in China. And the recent decline of the renminbi is a very important episode in the contest between the right and the left. The right would obviously like to pursue rather unrestrained capital account liberalization, allow the internationalization of the renminbi to take a form which is very similar to that of other major currencies, particularly the dollar. And the left in the Chinese Communist Party would be very cautious of this. They are very aware of the sorts of problems such internationalization can bring, particularly that it requires levels of financialization which the Chinese can ill afford if they are going to continue this high level of growth. So in a certain sense, basically, people are looking at the decline of the renminbi and they're thinking, well, if the U.S. rhetoric was to be believed, the renminbi was undervalued and the liberalization of the controls over the renminbi should have led to a rise in the renminbi. Why is it falling? The chief reason it's falling is because the capital account liberalization has led directly to a vast amount of capital flight from China. And I think that if the managers of the Chinese economy and the Chinese capital account are observing this, they will realize that this will be the result of capital account liberalization, and they need to go back to managing the capital account much more directly and much more cautiously, and not look at the kind of internationalization of the renminbi that, say, would mimic the dollar or anything. So I think that that's the most important lesson. And I think that this catastrophe of the renminbi should be an object lesson and should actually strengthen the hand of the left in China.
Okay. Well, we have seen a tendency away from that China as major export-oriented economy to more domestic consumption. And we like one of the developments that we've noticed, you know, that's gotten some attention is that the whole idea of the creating all these ghost towns that nobody is occupying, or at the very least that there are apartments and facilities and so on that are priced outside of what the domestic population can afford. So I'm wondering if that in some way translates into a lack of confidence in that model of...
Yes. I think they're two related but slightly different issues. So let me just take them up one by one. So the first is that you're talking about the reorientation of the Chinese growth path. And I think one of the things we must note about it, and I think people even in the mainstream financial press are beginning to note, even IMF World Bank figures are beginning to note, is that the Chinese economy is now consciously, Chinese Communist Party leaders are consciously pursuing a path of economic growth that is led by the domestic economy, that is focused on the domestic economy. So they are not looking for markets abroad. They are looking for markets within the economy. And that implies two things. Basically, one, you step up the level of investment. And number two, you seek to increase the level of consumption of your own population, which can only be a good thing. In fact, it will also hopefully rectify a problem that has emerged in the Chinese pattern of growth, which is rising levels of inequality. If the government focuses on creating growth by stimulating demand of its own relatively poorer sections of the population, I think this will also lead to a relatively greater reduction of inequality in China. And of course, with 1 billion-plus people, it will be an enormous stimulus to growth. So that's one thing. The second issue was about investment. And you were talking about these reports that are often splashed around the Western press about, you know, cities in which nobody lives and roads that go nowhere and so on. And yes, there have been such reports. But my understanding is, and I'm here relying on the work of a friend and colleague who's been studying the Chinese economy very closely, very often it turns out that it's a bit like the dated picture story that we are seeing with these the hungry people in Syria and so on. Pictures are taken at a moment in time when, say, a project is completed, but people have not come to live there. And often within a few months, a month or two, this place is actually populated and it's being used and so on. So again, while there is always a possibility that investment can overshoot, and that it is likely that there are some instances of such empty roads or buildings, they are, the extent to which they exist have also been highly exaggerated. So and of course, by the way, investment overshooting can happen in any economy. In fact, this happened in the 1990s in the United States, where the pressure of the dot-com boom, there was a huge and misdirected investment in the ICT sector. And now there is an overcapacity, which the United States economy is still suffering from in this sector in particular. So I would say that, again, this is something that the problem that this represents is exaggerated in China.
Now, I'm kind of interested. There are a couple of developments in recent years that do seem to threaten the larger, to be affecting a larger global transformation of economics. One being the development of the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, mm-hmm. and the other the One Belt One Road project, and these seem to be, in my layman's view, like kind of doing an end run around the institutions like the Bretton Woods World Bank, the Asian Development Bank in Japan. And so I'm wondering how that's going to impact, given the current global environment.
Well, I would say that it has the potential to absolutely revolutionize international economic governance in a variety of ways. I mean, revolutionize may seem like a strong word, and I don't think that, developments may unfold gradually or very fast. I cannot predict that. But nevertheless, look at it this way. For many decades, the world has lived under a system of international economic governance, which has been powered by the insistence that countries open up their capital account, and they have been told that if they do so, then Western capital will flow into their economies and allocate, investment in a judicious and proper way, and they will expand the productive capacity of all these economies. But typically, what has occurred is the complete opposite. opposite. Countries that have liberalized their capital accounts have not had any productive capital flowing in. On the contrary, the only kind of capital that has flown in is short-term capital that comes in like a herd and goes out like a herd. And when it goes out like a herd, it causes currency crises. Sort of the most dramatic instance of such currency crises was the East Asian economic crisis, where, you know, whereas throughout the 1990s, as capital accounts were liberalized, there was one financial crisis after another, the tequila crisis and the Russian crisis and even the Swedish crisis and so on and so forth. But the point is, the East Asian financial crisis was particularly important because it hit otherwise dynamic economies whose with which there was nothing wrong, whose fundamentals had been praised by everybody just days before the crisis occurred. So what that East Asian economic financial crisis showed to people is that this kind of capital can come in and go out. So if you wish to maintain an open capital account, then you also need to engage in reserve accumulation, which tends to divert funds away from productive investment, even more funds away from. So not only are you not getting in funds for productive investment, keeping an open capital account requires you to accumulate reserves, which further diverts more money away from productive investment. Now, this is the scenario so far. Now, what the Chinese are offering is a completely new pattern of finance. And I'd like to say a couple of things about it. We say that the Chinese economy suffers from a great deal of inequality. A large chunk of this inequality is regional inequality. And part of the regional inequality stems from the fact that the west of China is relatively underdeveloped. All this booming growth has taken place along its eastern seaboard. So the new Silk Road, Asian Infrastructure Development Investment Bank, One Belt, One Road, etc. All these initiatives are together not only looking westward to Central Asian republics, to Russia, to Europe and to India and so on, but it is also focused on developing China's own west. And I think that can only be a good thing. So good. That's very good. Number two, abroad, what they are offering the rest of the world is a pattern of finance, which is the complete opposite and in a practically every way of the Western model of finance. So it is offering long-term capital, not short-term capital. It is offering productive capital, not speculative capital. It is offering capital in a format which does not require capital account liberalization, and therefore it would not require expensive reserve accumulation. So if you think about all these things, the patterns of finance are completely different. Now, I would say that we are looking at the eclipse of one pattern of finance, the Western US-led, and the rise of the sunrise of another, sunset of the one, the sunrise of the other, primarily because it's a no-brainer. For any governments trying to develop their economies, they can see that the other one is better. And the one single sign that those who are the cognoscenti realize that this is happening is that Britain, despite the vocal objections of the United States, has joined the Asian Infrastructure Development Bank, because the British have one very important objective, which is to retain London's position as the center of world finance. Now, if their ears are to the ground, if the ears of the City of London are to the ground, then they will realize that that this is the new pattern of finance.
Sounds Britain like a barometer of sorts.
Exactly. And that London better have a hand in it so that it can start specializing and become a sort of hub for this new type of finance. And absolutely, this is a remarkable indicator, you know, because for the last century, the City of London has played a sort of subordinate role to New York. Now, will it be playing a subordinate role to Shanghai instead? This is becomes a very interesting question.
Yes, indeed. And I suppose as we watch on in the months and years to come, we'll start to see answers to that. Radhika Desai, I want to thank you very much for sharing your analysis and your insights with us.
Thank you, Michael.
We've been speaking with Radhika Desai, Professor at the Department of Political Studies at the University of Manitoba and Director of the Geopolitical Economy Research Group based at the University of Manitoba.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Jack Rasmus is a professor of economics and politics at St. Mary's College in California. His research focuses on global economic inequalities, and he has a new book out all about the global economic crisis. It's called Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy. Dr. Rasmus hosts a regular program called Alternative Visions on the Progressive Radio Network, and many of his essays appear on the Global Research site. So, Dr. Rasmus, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure for being here.
Okay, so first of all, I just wanted to quiz you a bit on your own understanding of the recent turmoil affecting the Chinese stock market.
Well, if you look at the immediate causes, what you see in China going on is a mutual exacerbating effect between the currency decline, the stock market decline, and the real economy slowing down. By the way, that real economy is slowing down much faster than it's being reported. China says it's 6.9% GDP growth rate, but I believe it's actually 5% and maybe even less. Some say it's as low as 3%, independent researchers. In any event, it's much slower than it is. And of course, when your economy slows down, that means the businesses aren't doing very well. And they're not going to increase their profits and their revenue, and therefore the stock price isn't going to go up. Therefore, the price isn't going to go up. It may go down. You want to get out of the stock. So that's one of the forces that's behind the stock decline in China, which really has begun to unravel since late last June. We had a 35% decline in the stock market between June and August, which was the result of a massive bubble that had occurred in the stock market over just the previous year. Stocks had risen by 120%. That's clearly a bubble. We'll talk about the causes of the bubble a little bit if you like, but now we're in a second downward leg since the end of December here in the stock market, and that's a reflection in part of the growing problem of debt in the private sector among the industrial companies, manufacturing companies, and so forth in China over the years here. Another factor is the currency decline. The yuan, the currency, is under great pressure to decline. And, of course, if your currency declines, then the value of the investments you're holding in that currency declines simply because the currency declines. Well, if the investment is the stock price and so forth is going to decline because you expect the currency to continue to decline, then you want to get out of stocks as well. And then, we have a situation where the stock market decline puts pressure on the currency decline. In other words, if I'm selling stocks, I'm going to cash out my stock. I'm going to get paid in yuan, right, the Chinese currency. I'm then going to want to get my money out of the stock market and out of yuan itself and buy other currency. So I'm going to sell the yuan. I'm going to increase the supply of yuan, and the yuan's going to decline even further. So we have this mutual three-way effect going on between the currency decline, GDP slowing down, and the stock market decline. That's all mutually determining each other, and it's all going south. And you see it reflected in this massive capital flight coming out of China since the stock market began to decline. If you look at government efforts to support the yuan, the currency, and to support the stock market in the past year, and capital flight, private capital flight, we have about $1 trillion at least of money flowing out of the markets and out of China itself in the past year, $1 trillion. That's a huge amount of money that otherwise might have been used for investment, whether it's financial investment or real investment. So that's what's going on there in China, massive capital flight. And to the extent that, by the way, I would say another force here, to the extent that the dollar rises, long-term interest rates rise, and therefore the U.S. dollar rises, global oil continues to decline. There's a direct inverse relationship between global oil, the crash in global oil commodity prices that began in the middle of 2014, and the rise of the dollar. They're both linked. That decline in the price, because oil is a financial asset, not just a physical commodity, you see, since 1999, that exacerbates the whole situation. And the situation is not just China. China's obvious, since it's so large and so important as a single economy in the global scenario, but all the emerging markets are in the same boat. In other words, currency decline, capital flight, slowing economies, and so forth. When you have a currency decline, policymakers can do one of two things. They can raise interest rates to try to keep money capital in their economy, but of course that slows down their real economy as well. Or they can use their reserves, currency reserves on hand, to buy the currency to keep it from falling. China has massive currency reserves, of course, but they've committed at least $500 billion to support the stock market decline by getting Chinese government banks and Chinese government state-owned enterprises and other sources to buy currencies to keep the stock market and keep the currency up, you see. But it's not working. Even though they have these massive reserves, it might slow down the collapse, the implosion in the financial asset markets, the stock market, the currency market, and so forth. But it's not going to stop it. Well, emerging markets like in Latin America and elsewhere, they don't have those kind of reserves, and their economies are just plummeting, and they're going to continue. I've been saying for some time that we're heading towards another financial crisis, but it's not going to be in the U.S. or even Europe. It's going to come from emerging markets. China's going to precipitate it and then control its collapse because it has these reserves, but the emerging markets aren't going to be able to. You see, in 2009 and 10, China stimulated its economy with a 15% of its GDP, a massive fiscal stimulus, direct government investment and spending, and exports. That massive spending, fiscal spending, as well as an accompanying monetary stimulus, drove up the China's economy to 10-14% GDP growth rates. Well, the rest of the emerging markets provided commodities and semi-finished goods to China, so their economies boomed as well. So China pulled up the rest of the emerging markets, and the growth was so lucrative in China emerging markets that this massive monetary liquidity injection by the Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank, Bank of England, so forth, which is $20 to $30 trillion since 2009 in QE and zero interest rates. Much of this huge liquidity injection flowed into China and emerging markets. It flowed out of the U.S. That's why we didn't get a very fast recovery in the U.S. We have a 1/2 to 2/3 normal recovery. Because the money flowed out, and the money also flowed into financial assets and speculation. That's why you see the stock and bond markets in the U.S. Doubled, tripled, with huge capital gains and money, and thus incoming inequality, further trends in the U.S. One of the main characteristics of 21st century capitalism is this shift, as I call it in my book, to financial asset investing.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty important consideration because, I mean, we're talking about – when we talk about like real assets, we're talking about something like concrete, like literally, building and with stuff that's creating jobs as opposed to financial assets where we're basically talking about money-making money, debt-making money.
Yes, well, see, the liquidity injected by the central banks, 20 to 30 trillion, however you measure it, turns into debt. The central bank gives this free money because interest rates are zero. Banks and shadow banks, particularly, thus the unregulated banks, you know, equity funds and hedge funds and so forth, can go to the central bank and get free money, essentially. And what do they do with that free money, this $20 to $30 trillion? What they do is loan it to other investors, other businesses, if they're multinationals, or then they themselves invest it. Where do they invest it? Well, when China emerging markets are booming, they may invest it in real assets. In other words, buildings and plants and equipment and so forth. That's real assets. But they also invest it in financial assets, securities, stocks, bonds, derivatives, foreign exchange, and so forth. So a lot of the money flowing out went into both financial assets and into real assets offshore. In the U.S., it mostly, in Europe, it mostly went into financial assets. And that's why we get these stock bubbles, these financial asset stock and debt bubbles. So the liquidity turns into debt, you see. That's what's important to understand. You can't have this massive increase in global debt, which, according to estimates by the Bank of International Settlements, is $40 trillion since 2010 through 2013. The BIS is located in Geneva. It's kind
Bank of International
the bank
Settlements.
Of the central banks, you might say. It does a lot of research. And they've been raising this flag for a couple of years, and correctly so. It's probably at least $50 trillion in additional debt since 2010, much of which has gone into financial speculation and financial assets around the world.
So a debt boom is what you do in 2012?
Yeah, well, the debt, you know, is the big problem that led, excess debt led to the 2008-09 problem. There, the debt flowed into property markets and other credit markets associated with it, and the prices got to an unsustainable level, and when they collapsed, you know, the ability to pay for that debt, the principal and interest, collapsed, and then the financial assets collapsed. You know, that was the problem back then. Well, we got a similar problem brewing, but it's not in properties and housing and so forth, and it's not in the derivatives that were the problem back then, CDSs, CDOs, and so forth. You know, today it's in new forms, in new places, but it's there, you see, and it's going to explode, especially in emerging markets where most, at least $25 trillion, half of this $50 trillion debt has accumulated, and the debt is accumulated heavily, like in places like Latin America, in dollars. So Latin American countries have to export more in order to earn dollars to pay the interest on that $25 trillion debt. The problem is the global economy is slowing, so they're not earning those dollars anymore. And it's harder and harder for them to pay that debt, and we're going to see defaults as a result.
Okay. Just going back to China, and you were talking debt. Their total debt's risen from $7.5 trillion to $28 trillion last year. So that's China's just about the most indebted country in the world at this point. So,
oh, yes. It's a massive debt problem. And I have a chapter in my book, Systemic Fragility, just on China, as well as on just on Japan, Europe, emerging markets, and the U.S. So, you know, I look at this debt problem in all these areas. But the debt problem, you have to understand, is really the liquidity problem. Liquidity translates into the debt problem. And the debt problem by itself is not sufficient to look at. It's the ability to pay for the debt, i.e. income flows, in relationship to the debt. You just can't talk about this huge run-up in debt and say, that's the problem. Well, how does debt translate into the problem? Well, it's the inability to pay, to make payments on the debt. Because when you accumulate huge amounts of debt, when you have a cyclical downturn, a recession, your income falls, right? If you're a company, a business, or a government, because your tax income falls. So the income available to pay for the debt declines, but the debt never declines, you see. The debt is really there, and that's the problem, because if you can't pay for the debt, make your payments on the debt because you don't have the income, well, then you default. When you default or about to default, your expectations of default mean that your prices of your assets collapse. You see, they totally fall, and that sets off a financial panic that goes from one market, credit market, to the next credit market. Because the people who are buying and using all this debt are the same people around the world. In my book, which, by the way, you can obtain going to my blog, jackrasmus.com, or you can just go to Amazon if you want it. Much more detail there. The problem with the debt is the ability to pay for it, that relationship. Most economists don't understand that. You know, mainstream economists think, oh, well, debt is good. It's okay. You know, people use it to finance real investment. No, they're using it to finance speculative financial assets because they are far more profitable than investing in real assets anymore. That's why we have this shift to financial speculation and financial asset investment going on. And we have a structural change in the 21st century capitalist economy in which we have this new finance structure of shadow banks all around the world that are sitting on, estimates are, you know, maybe $100 trillion in investable assets, $100 trillion.
Now, and how many of those shadow banks are in China currently? I mean, that's a recent phenomenon in China, right?
Yeah, in 2009, there were no shadow banks in China. And that's part of the problem why we have this huge liquidity escalation in China that has led to this debt in China. Part of it has been the government pumping People's Bank of China, their central bank, pumping all this money liquidity into the economy to feed this fiscal stimulus that they had. But they also, China also opened up its economy to Western shadow banks, you see. And the U.S. has been putting pressure on Beijing for years to do that. And now, you know, they progressively did that. And also various kinds of shadow banks arose for the first time in China. You know, there's thousands, about 6,000 shadow banks, the estimates I've seen, in China. Purely domestic shadow banks of various kinds, some very small, others very large, you know. Plus the Western shadow banks play in China. They buy and sell. They've been buying commodities outside China. They sell those commodities in China when there was a big demand for those commodities. Then they convert that money from the commodity sales in China into Chinese currency yuan, and they speculate in China. A lot of that speculation back in 2011-12 resulted in this huge boom in local government infrastructure and housing spending. That became a bubble. Local governments borrowed from shadow banks and other sources, and they engage in this huge building boom. And of course, when you borrow, you have all that excess debt, and they caused a bubble in property prices. Well, China tried to start controlling that bubble around 2012-13 by slowing down the construction by raising interest rates. But every time they did that, they slowed down the Chinese economy itself, the real economy. So after a while, they got a little smarter, and they figured, well, you know, we instead of trying to eliminate that bubble, let's divert all the speculation somewhere else. So they moved the money by various incentives out of the bubble, the construction bubble. They moved it into what's called asset management products.
And that just created another bubble there.
That created another bubble, right. The idea was WIMPs, wealth management products, as they're called, were designed to fund the investment in state-owned and other industrial enterprises, which, you know, to expand manufacturing and so forth. So the money flowed out of the property bubble into the industrial bubble, you might say, entrusted loans, they were called. And they created a bubble in entrusted loans, and industrial enterprises in China became heavily indebted as well as local government. you see. And then they figured China policymakers in late 2013 figured, well, we're trying to make this conversion from direct government investment, which is about 45% of the GDP there, and export-driven, we're trying to move it to consumption and private investment-driven, was the whole idea. You may have read about this conversion thing. Then to do that, they tried to divert the bubble out of entrusted loans and speculation on the industrial side into the stock market. You see, this big balloon in the stock market, 120% rise in 1 year, is in large part the consequence of Chinese government policymakers inviting more shadow banks, more foreign money into the stock market, and also pretty much eliminating any controls on what's called margin buying for average investors in the stock market. And by margin buying, you know, it means you increase your debt and you don't even, the government doesn't even have to provide money. Margin buying is if the value of your stock or your financial asset is accelerating, the broker will loan you the equivalent of the value increase to buy more stock. So you get all these retail investors and those small investors jumping in late 2014-15, borrowing money from and increasing their own debt, borrowing money from brokers and so forth, and foreign money. All that boosted up the stock market. And the idea was if we get more people investing in stock, the company's stock will rise in value. And because it rises in value, the company will be more apt to use that profit, that capital gains profit, to expand the real economy, to invest and expand the real economy. And high-end consumers making profit off of the stock market will increase their consumption. Hence, you know, we will boost through a stock bubble, we will boost the real economy. That's called the wealth effect, you know. But it didn't work. It just resulted in more
what
and more
we're seeing
problems.
Now, yeah. Ultimately.
Okay. Same thing has happened in the U.S. You know, the Federal Reserve pumping all this trillions of dollars into the economy was really designed with the same logic in mind. In other words, let's create a wealth effect in the stock market where all these companies would get so profitable that they would then, you know, divert some of that profit into expanding the real side of their economy. And then consumers also will be able to those playing in the stock market will have a wealth effect, and they will consume more. At least the top 10% that play in the stock market in the U.S. But it didn't happen here either. You see, that's the capitalist monetarist approach. Let's boost the incomes of corporations and speculators and the high end, and because they're so filthy rich now, they will trickle down some of it into real investment, and that will pull up the rest of the economy, jobs, and so on and so forth. But they're not doing it. They're sitting on the money, you know, in the U.S. They're hoarding their cash or diverting it into financial markets or diverting it offshore for a while. That stopped in the last couple of years. Or they're just sitting on it. If you look at the U.S. alone here, corporations, you know, the profits more than doubled. They issued $5 trillion in new bonds, which means they get, you know, money in exchange for the bonds. And what did they do with all that money? They gave it back to their shareholders, right? $7 trillion of returned cash to shareholders in stock buybacks and dividend payouts just in the U.S., right? Wow. And globally, corporations are still sitting on $7 to $8 trillion in cash. So $15 trillion has been created and either remains on their balance sheets or they've returned it back to their shareholders. But where's the real investment from this? You know, the whole faulty logic of mainstream economics is that if you somehow increase the cash flow on hand, of corporations, they will then automatically, ipso facto, invest it in expansion, and that would mean more jobs and more income and more spending and therefore GDP. That's mm-hmm. the supply side logic. But it's not working. They're hoarding it, or they're diverting it into financial assets around the world. You know, these 200,000 of what I call the new finance capital elite. There's about 200,000 of these investors, about 70,000 in the U.S., and they're the ones who have created all these liquid markets for all these new financial securities, derivatives of all kinds, and that's where they're investing because it's so much more profitable than investing in real assets that create real jobs and real things and real income. By real people. That's the big shift in capitalism in the 21st century.
Now,
that's what is meant by financialization. It's this whole picture, this whole changed financial structure, the new liquid markets, the new finance capital elites, the new securities. You can move them around now electronically, immediately. And this is what they're doing with all their wealth, you see, and it's not trickling down anymore.
So what is the global outlook for, resulting from these developments? Do you see winners? Do you see degrees of losing? How is this going to play out?
Yeah, well, those who get into these financial bubbles first, you know, those who know where they're coming or create them themselves are the winners, and those who get out late are the losers, and the big losers are usually the small retail investors, they call them, you know, the mom and pop who thinks that they can play in foreign exchange markets and stock markets, derivatives, and so forth, and they lose their shirt. And it's like a global money parade. The money moves into this particular market in this geographic location. Okay, we got a bubble. Now we're going to pull out. We're going to go over here. And the money just keeps circulating around. And the real economy languishes as a result. And we see these financial bubbles begin to implode. The Chinese stock market is an imploding bubble, and it's about to have a serious effect on the rest of the stock markets because it's the same 200,000 people who are driving these markets everywhere. And the contagion is psychological, at least on the financial asset side. Who's going to win? Massive capital flight out of emerging markets in China. The people who are moving their capital out are going to be winners. So, it's just sitting out there. This time bomb is sitting out there. And all the huge debt increase on top of that is sitting out there. And once the income starts declining more rapidly, which is driven by the price declines, we're going to see a lot more defaults.
Okay.
And that psychological effect, then we're going to see the stock markets really collapse.
Well, Professor Rasmus, I want to thank you very much for your analysis and remind our listeners that they can read more about your insights into the deep fundamentals of our current global crisis by getting a copy of your book. It's Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, and it's available at through jackrasmus.com. You can get some material there as well as on Amazon.
Yeah, there's some free chapters on my website, and you can get to it from jackrasmus.com. There's a photo jacket of the book. Just click on that. I have a chapter free for anyone to read there on China, my view of China and what's happening there and what will happen and the contagion effects that are coming here for the rest of the global economy.
Jack Rasmus, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Michael.
We've been speaking with Jack Rasmus. He is a professor of economics and politics at St. Mary's College in California and the author of Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com.
I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.